This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Lady of the Lake, written by Andrzej Sapkowski, translated from the Polish by David French, read by Peter Kenny.
Chapter 1. The lake was enchanted. There was absolutely no doubt about it. Firstly, it lay right beside the mouth of the enchanted Kumpoika Valley, permanently veiled in mist and famed for witchcraft and magical phenomena. Secondly, it was enough to look. The lake was deep, a vivid, pure blue, just like polished sapphire. It was as smooth as a looking glass. So smooth, the peaks of the Yr Oeddfa Massif, gazing into it, seemed more stunning reflected than in reality. A cold, bracing wind blew in from the lake, and nothing disturbed the dignified silence, not even the splash of a fish or the cry of a water bird. The knight shuddered in amazement. But instead of continuing to ride along the ridge, he steered his horse towards the lake, as though lured by the magical power of the witchcraft slumbering down there, at the bottom, in the depths. The horse trod timidly across broken rocks, showing by a soft snorting that it also sensed the magical aura. After descending to the very bottom of the valley, the knight dismounted. Leading his steed by the bridle, he neared the water's edge, where faint ripples were playing among colourful pebbles. He kneeled down, his chain mail rustling, scaring away fry, fish as tiny and lively as needles. He scooped up water in his cupped hands. He drank slowly and gingerly, the ice-cold water numbing his lips and tongue and stinging his teeth. As he stooped again, a sound, carried over the surface of the water, reached his ears. He raised his head. His horse snorted as though confirming it had also heard. He listened. No. It was no illusion. What he had heard was singing. A woman singing, or more likely, a girl. The knight, like all knights, had been raised on stories of bards and tales of chivalry, and in them, 9 times out of 10, girlish airs or wailing were bait, and the knights that followed them usually fell into traps, often fatal ones. But his curiosity got the better of him. The knight, after all, was only 19 years old. He was very bold and very imprudent. He was famous for the first and known for the second. He checked that his sword slid well in the scabbard, then tugged his horse and headed along the shore in the direction of the singing. He didn't have to go far. On the lakeside lay great dark boulders, worn smooth to a shine. You might have said they were the playthings of giants, carelessly tossed there or forgotten after a game. Some of the boulders lay in the lake, looming black beneath the crystalline water. Some of them protruded above the surface. Washed by the wavelets, they looked like the backs of leviathans. But most of them lay on the lakeside, covering the shore all the way to the tree line. Some of them were buried in the sand, only partly sticking out, leaving their true size to the imagination. The singing that the knight could hear came from just behind the rocks near the shore, and the girl who was doing the singing was out of sight. He led his horse, holding it by the bit and nostrils to stop it whinnying or snorting. The girl's garments were spread on a perfectly flat boulder lying in the lake. She, naked and waist-deep in the water, was washing and singing the while. The knight didn't recognize the words. And no wonder. The girl, he would have bet his life, was not flesh and blood. That was evident from her slim figure, the strange color of her hair and her voice. He was certain that were she to turn around, he would see huge, almond-shaped eyes. And were she to brush aside her ashen hair, he would surely see pointed ears. She was a dweller of fairy, a spirit, one of the Tylwyth Teg, one of those creatures the Picts and Irish called Daoine Shi, the folk of the hill, one of those creatures the Saxons called elves. The girl stopped singing for a moment, submerged herself up to the neck, snorted, and swore very coarsely. It didn't fool the knight, though. Fairies, as was widely known, could curse like humans, oftentimes more filthily than stablemen. And very often, the oath preceded a spiteful prank for which fairies were famous. For example, swelling someone's nose up to the size of a cucumber, or shrinking another's manhood down to the size of a broad bean. Neither the first nor the second possibility appealed to the knight. He was on the point of a discreet withdrawal when the noise of hooves on the pebbles suddenly betrayed him. No, not his own steed, which, being held by the nostrils, was as calm and quiet as a mouse. He had been betrayed by the fairy's horse, a black mare, which at first the knight hadn't noticed among the rocks. Now the pitch-black animal churned up the pebbles with a hoof and neighed a greeting. The knight's stallion tossed its head and neighed back politely. So loudly, an echo sped across the water. The fairy burst from the water, for a moment presenting herself to the knight in all her alluring splendour. She darted towards the rock where her clothing lay. But rather than seizing a blouse and covering up modestly, the she-elf grabbed a sword and drew it from its scabbard with a hiss, whirling it with admirable dexterity. It lasted but a short moment, after which she sank down, covering herself up to her nose in the water, and extending her arm with the sword above the surface. The knight shook off his stupefaction, released the reins, and genuflected, kneeling on the wet sand, for he realized at once who was before him. "Hail," he mumbled, holding out his hands. "Great is the honour for me. Great is the accolade, O Lady of the Lake. I shall accept the sword. Could you get up from your knees and turn away?" The fairy stuck her mouth above the water. "Perhaps you'd stop staring and let me get dressed?" He obeyed. He heard her splash out of the water, rustle her clothes, and swear softly as she pulled them over her wet body. He examined the black mare, its coat as smooth and lustrous as moleskin. It was certainly a horse of noble blood, certainly enchanted, and undoubtedly also a dweller of fairy, like its owner. "You may turn around, Lady of the Lake, and introduce yourself. I am Galahad of Caer Bennett's, a knight of King Arthur, the Lord of Camelot, the ruler of the Summerland, and also of Dumnonia, Divnant, Powys, Divid, and Temeria," she interrupted. "Redania, Rivier, Adrian, Nilfgaard. Do those names mean anything to you?"
"No, I've never heard them."
She shrugged. Apart from her sword, she was holding her boots and her blouse, washed and wrung out.
"I thought so. What day of the year is it today?"
"It is." He opened his mouth, utterly astonished.
"The second full moon of the Beltana, Lady
Siri," she said dully, wriggling her shoulders to allow her garments to lie better on her drying skin. She spoke strangely. Her eyes were large and green. She involuntarily brushed her wet hair aside, and the knight gasped unwittingly. Not just because her ear was normal, human, and in no way elven. Her cheek was disfigured by a large, ugly scar. She had been wounded. But could a fairy be wounded? She noticed his look, narrowed her eyes, and wrinkled her nose.
"That's right, it's a scar,"
she repeated in her extraordinary accent.
"Why do you look so scared? Is a scar such a strange thing for a knight to see? Is it so ugly?"
He removed his chainmail hood with both hands and brushed aside his hair. "Indeed it isn't," he said, not without youthful pride, displaying a barely healed scar of his own, running from temple to jaw. "And only blemishes on one's honour are ugly. I am Galahad, son of Lancelot du Lac and Elaine, daughter of King Pelles, lord of Caer Bennett's.
That wound was dealt me by Broyunis the Merciless, a base oppressor of maidens, before I felled him in a fair duel. In sooth, I am worthy of receiving that sword from your hands, O Lady of the Lake.
I beg your pardon?
The sword. I'm ready to receive it. It's my sword. I don't let anyone touch it. But what?
The Lady of the Lake always emerges from the waters and bestows a sword, doesn't she?
She said nothing for some time.
I get it, she finally said. Well, every country has its own customs. I'm sorry, Galahad, or whatever your name is, but I'm clearly not the lady I'm meant to be. I'm not giving away anything, and I won't let anyone take anything from me, just to make things clear.
But, he ventured, you must come from Faerie, don't you, my lady?
I come,
she said a moment later, and her green eyes seemed to be looking into an abyss of space and time.
I come from Rivia, from the city of the same name, from Loch Escalot. I sailed here by boat. It was foggy. I couldn't see the shore. I only heard the neighing of Kelpie, my mare, who followed me.
She spread out her wet blouse on a stone, and the knight gasped again. The blouse had been washed, but perfunctorily. Patches of blood were still visible.
The current brought me here,
the girl began again, either not seeing what he had noticed or pretending not to.
The current and the spell of a unicorn. What's this lake called?
I don't know, he confessed. There are so many lakes in Gwynedd.
In Gwynedd?
Naturally. Those mountains are Eroitha. If you keep them on your left hand and ride through the forests, after 2 days you'll reach Dinas Dinllu, and then on to Caer Datal, and the river. The nearest river is... Never mind what the nearest river's called. Do you have anything to eat, Galahad? I'm simply dying of hunger.
Why are you watching me like that? Afraid I'll disappear? That I'll fly off with your hardtack and smoked sausage? Don't worry. I got up to some mischief in my own world and confused destiny, so I shouldn't show my face there for the moment. I'll stay a while in yours,
in a world where one searches the sky in vain for the dragon or the seven goats, where right now it's the second full moon after Beltane, and Beltane is pronounced Beltana.
Why are you staring at me like that, pray?
I didn't know fairies could eat.
Fairies, sorceresses and she-elves, they all eat and drink and so on.
I beg your pardon.
Never mind.
The more intently he observed her, the more she lost her enchanting aura and the more human and ordinary, common even, she became. Though he knew she wasn't, couldn't be that. One didn't encounter common wenches at the foot of Eroitha in the region of Cumpoica, bathing naked in mountain lakes and washing blood-stained blouses. Never mind what the girl looked like, she couldn't be an earthly being. In spite of that, Galahad was now gazing quite freely and without fear at her ashen hair, which now it was dry, to his amazement, gleamed grey. At her slender hands, petite nose and pale lips, at her masculine outfit of somewhat outlandish cut, sewn from delicate stuff of extremely dense weave. At her sword of curious construction and ornamentation, but by no means resembling a ceremonial accoutrement. At her bare feet, caked with the dried sand of the beach.
Just for clarity, she began, rubbing one foot against the other, I'm not a she-elf, and as for being an enchantress, a fairy... I'm a little unusual. I don't think I'm one at all.
I'm sorry, I really am.
Why exactly? They say...
He blushed and stammered.
They say that when fairies meet young men, they lead them to Elfland and there, beneath a filbert bush on a carpet of moss, they order them to render...
I understand. She glanced at him quickly, then bit down hard on a sausage. "Regarding the land of elves," she said, swallowing, I fled from there some time ago, and am in no hurry to return. Regarding, however, the rendering of services on mossy carpets. Truly, Galahad, you've happened upon the wrong lady. All the same, I thank you kindly for your good intentions. Milady, I did not wish to offend. You don't have to apologize.
Only because, he mumbled, you're enchantingly comely.
Thank you once again, but still, nothing's going to happen.
They were silent for a time. It was warm. The sun, standing at its zenith, warmed the stones pleasantly. A faint breeze ruffled the surface of the lake.
What does?
Galahad began suddenly in a strange, enraptured voice.
What does the spear with the bloody blade mean? Why does the king with a lanced thigh suffer, and what does it mean? What is the meaning of the maiden in white carrying a grail, a silver bowl? And besides that,
she interrupted him, are you feeling all right?
I merely ask, and I merely don't understand your question. Is it some previously agreed password? Some signal by which the initiated recognize each other? Kindly explain.
But I cannot.
Why then did you ask?
Because, he stammered, well, to put it briefly, one of our number failed to ask when he had the chance. He grew tongue-tied or was embarrassed. He didn't ask, and because of that, there was great unpleasantness. So now we always ask, just in case.
Are there sorcerers in this world? You know, people who practice the magical arts, mages, knowing ones.
There's Merlin and Morgana, but Morgana is evil.
And Merlin?
Average.
Do you know where to find him?
I'll say, in Camelot, at the court of King Arthur. I'm presently headed there.
Is it far?
From here to Powys, to the River Havrin, then downstream to Glavum, to the Sea of Sabina, and from there to the flatlands of the Summerland. All in all, some 10 days' ride.
Too far.
One may, he stammered, take a shortcut by riding through Comboica, but it is an enchanted valley. It is dreadful there. One hears of O'Dun and Bach Tedwell living there, evil little men.
What? Do you only carry a sword for decoration?
And what would a sword achieve against witchcraft?
Much, much.
Don't worry. I'm a witcher. Ever heard of one?
Pshaw, naturally you haven't. And I'm not afraid of your little men. I have plenty of dwarf friends.
Of course you do, he thought.
Lady of the Lake, my name's Ciri. Don't call me Lady of the Lake.
Brings up bad, unpleasant, nasty associations. That's what they called me in the land of...
What did you call that place?
Fairy. Or, as the Druids say, Anon. And the Saxons say Elfland.
Elfland.
She wrapped a tartan Pictish rug he had given her around her shoulders.
I've been there, you know. I entered the Tower of the Swallow and bang, I was among the elves. And that's exactly what they called me, the Lady of the Lake. I even liked it at the start. It was flattering. Until the moment I understood I was no lady in that land, in that tower by the lake, but a prisoner.
Was it there, he blurted out, that you stained your blouse with blood?
She was silent for a long time.
No,
she said finally. And her voice, it seemed to him, trembled a little.
Not there. You have sharp eyes. Oh, Will, you can't flee from the truth. Can't bury your head in the sand.
Yes, Galahad. I've often become stained lately, with the blood of the foes I've killed, and the blood of the friends I tried hard to rescue, and who died in my arms. Why do you stare at me so?
I know not if you be a deity or a mortal, or one of the goddesses. But if you are a dweller on this earth of ours, get to the point if you would.
I
would listen to your story. Galahad's eyes glowed. Would you tell it, O lady?
It is long.
We have time.
And it doesn't end so well.
I don't believe you.
Why?
You were singing when you were bathing in the lake.
You're observant.
She turned her head away, pursed her lips, and her face suddenly contorted and became ugly.
Yes, you're observant, but very naive.
Tell me your story, please.
Very well, she sighed. Very well, if you wish. I shall.
She made herself comfortable, as did he. The horses walked by the edge of the forest, nibbling grass and herbs.
From the beginning? Asked Galahad. From the very beginning. This story, she said a moment later,
wrapping herself more tightly in the Pictish rug,
seems more and more like one without a beginning. Neither am I certain if it has finished yet, either. The past, you have to know, has become awfully tangled up with the future. An elf even told me it's like that snake that catches its own tail in its teeth. That snake, you ought to know, is called a Ouroboros. And the fact it bites its own tail means the circle is closed. The past, present and future lurk in every moment of time. Eternity is hidden in every moment of time. Do you understand?
No.
Never mind.
Verily do I tell you, that whoever believes in dreams is as one trying to catch the wind or sees a shadow. He is deluded by a beguiling picture, a warped looking glass, which lies or utters absurdities in the manner of a woman in labour. Foolish indeed is he who lends credence to dreams and treads the path of delusion. Nonetheless, whoever disdains and does not believe them at all also acts unwisely. For if dreams had no import whatsoever, why then would the gods, in creating us, give us the ability to dream?
The Wisdom of the Prophet Lebioda, Chapter 34, Verse 1.
Chapter 2.
A light wind ruffled the surface of the lake, which was steaming like a cauldron, and drove ragged wisps of mist over it. Rollocks creaked and thudded rhythmically, the emerging oar blades scattering a hail of shining drops. Condwirrimuirs put a hand over the side. The boat was moving at such a snail's pace, the water barely foamed or climbed up her hand.
Oh my, she said, packing as much sarcasm into her voice as she could. What speed! We're hurtling over the waves. It's making my head spin.
The rower, a short, stocky, compact man, growled back angrily and indistinctly, not even raising his head, which was covered in a grisly mop of hair as curly as a caracal lamb's. The novice had put up with quite enough of the growling, hawking and grunting with which the boor had dismissed her questions since she had boarded.
"Have a care," she drawled, struggling to keep calm. "You might do yourself a mischief from such hard rowing."
This time, the man raised his face, which was as swarthy and weather-beaten as tanned leather. He grunted, hawked, and pointed his bristly grey chin at the wooden reel attached to the side of the boat and the line disappearing into the water, stretched tight by their movement. Clearly convinced the explanation was exhaustive, he resumed his rowing, with the same rhythm as previously. Oars up, a pause, blades halfway into the water, a long pause, the pull, an even longer pause.
"Aha!" Condwirrimuirs said nonchalantly, looking heavenwards. "I understand. What's important is the lure being pulled behind the boat, which has to move at the right speed and the right depth. Fishing is important. Everything else is unimportant."
What she said was so obvious, the man didn't even take the trouble to grunt or wheeze.
Who could it bother?
Kunvirumyord continued her monologue. That I've been travelling all night, that I'm hungry, that my backside hurts and itches from the hard wet bench, that I need a pee. No, only trolling for fish matters, which is pointless in any case. Nothing will take a lure pulled down the middle of the current at a depth of a score of fathoms. The man raised his head, looked at her foully, and grumbled very, very grumblingly. Condwirrimuir's flashed her little teeth, pleased with herself. The boar went on rowing slowly. He was furious. She lounged back on the stern bench and crossed her legs, letting her dress ride up. The man grunted, tightened his gnarled hands on the oars, and pretended only to be looking at the fishing line. He had no intention of rowing any faster, naturally. The novice sighed in resignation and turned her attention to the sky. The rowlocks creaked and the glistening drops fell from the oar blades. The outline of an island loomed up in the quickly dispersing mist, as did the dark, tapering obelisk of the tower rising above it. The boar, though he was facing forwards and not looking back, knew in some mysterious way that they had almost arrived. Without hurrying, he laid the oars on the gunwales, stood up, and began to slowly wind in the line on the reel. Condwirrimuir's legs still crossed, whistled, looking up at the sky. The man finished reeling in the line and examined the lure, a large brass spoon armed with a triple hook and a tassel of red wool. "Oh, my, oh, my," said Condwirrimuir's sweetly. "Haven't caught anything? Oh, dear, what a pity. I wonder why we've had such bad luck. Perhaps the boat was going too fast?" The man cast her a look which expressed many foul things. He sat down, hawked, spat over the side, grasped the oars in his great knotty hands, and bent his back powerfully. The oars splashed, rattled in the rowlocks, and the boat darted across the lake like an arrow, the water foaming with a whoosh against the prow, eddies seething astern. He covered the quarter arrow shot that separated them from the island in less than a grunt, and the boat came up onto the pebbles with such force that Condwirrimuir's lurched from the bench. The man grunted, hawked, and spat. The novice knew that meant, translated into the speech of civilized people, "Get out of my boat, you brash witch." She also knew she could forget about being carried ashore. She took off her slippers, lifted her dress provocatively high, and disembarked. She fought back a curse as mussel shells pricked her feet.
"Thanks," she said through clenched teeth, "for the ride."
Neither waiting for the answering grunt nor looking back, she walked barefoot towards the stone steps. All of her discomforts and problems vanished and evaporated without a trace, expunged by her growing excitement. She was there, on the island of Innisfitre, on Loch Blest. She was in an almost legendary place where only a select few had ever been. The morning mist had lifted completely, and the red orb of the sun had begun to show more brightly through the dull sky. Squawking gulls circled around the tower's battlements, and swifts flashed by. At the top of the steps leading from the beach to the terrace, leaning against a statue of a crouching, grinning chimera, was Nimue, the Lady of the Lake. She was dainty and short, measuring not much more than 5 feet. Condwirrimuir's had heard that when she was young she'd been called Squirt, and now she knew the nickname had been apt. But she was certain no one had dared call the little sorceress that for at least half a century.
"I am Condwirrimuir's Tilly,"
she introduced herself with a bow, a little embarrassed as she was still holding her slippers.
"I'm glad to be visiting your island, Lady of the Lake." "Nimue,"
the diminutive sorceress corrected her.
"Nimue. Nothing more. We can skip titles and honorifics, Miss Tilly." "In that case, I'm Condwirrimuir's. Condwirrimuir's, nothing more." "Come with me then, Condwirrimuir's. We shall talk over breakfast. I imagine you're hungry." "I don't deny it."
There was white curd cheese, chives, eggs, milk, and wholemeal bread for breakfast, served by 2 very young, very quiet serving girls who smelt of starch.
Khonhurimuyo's Et, feeling the gaze of the diminutive sorceress on her.
"The tower," Nemu said slowly, observing her every movement and almost every morsel she raised to her mouth, "has 6 stories, one of which is below ground. Your room is on the 2nd floor above ground. You will find every convenience needed for living. The ground floor, as you see, is the service area. The servants' quarters are also located here. The subterranean, 1st and 3rd floors, house the laboratory, library, and gallery. You may enter and have unfettered access to all the floors I've mentioned and the rooms there. You may take advantage of them and of what they contain when you wish and however you wish."
"I understand. Thank you."
"The uppermost 2 stories contain my private chambers and my private study. Those rooms are absolutely private. In order to avoid misunderstandings, I am extremely sensitive about such things."
"I shall respect that."
Nemu turned her head towards the window through which the grunting ferryman could be seen. He had already dealt with Khonhurimuyo's luggage and was now loading rods, reels, landing nets, scoop nets and other fishing tackle into his boat.
"I'm a little old-fashioned," she continued, "but I've become accustomed to having the exclusive use of certain things, like a toothbrush, let's say, my private chambers, library and toilet, and the Fisher King. Do not try, please, to avail yourself of the Fisher King."
Khonhurimuyo's almost choked on her milk. Nemu's face didn't express anything.
"And if," she continued, before the girl regained her speech, "if he tries to avail himself of you, decline him."
Khonhurimuyo's finally swallowed and nodded quickly, refraining from any comment whatsoever. Though it was on the tip of her tongue to say she didn't care for anglers, particularly boorish ones, with heads of dishevelled hair as white as curds.
"Good," Nemu drawled. "That's the introductions over and done with. Time to get down to business. Doesn't it interest you why I chose precisely you from among all the candidates?"
If Khonhurimuyo's pondered the answer at all, it was only so as not to appear too cocksure. She quickly concluded, though, that with Nemu, even the slightest false modesty would offend by its insincerity.
"I'm the best dream reader in the academy," she replied coolly,
matter-of-factly and without boastfulness.
"And in the 3rd year, I was 2nd among the oniromancers. I could have taken the number 1.
Nemu was brutal, frank.
"Incidentally, they suggested that high flyer somewhat insistently, as it happens, because she was apparently the important daughter of someone important. And where dream reading and oniromancy are concerned, you know yourself, my dear Khonhurimuyo's, that it's a pretty fickle gift. Fiascos can befall even the best dream reader."
Khonhurimuyo's kept to herself the riposte that she could count her fiascos on the fingers of one hand. After all, she was talking to a master. "Know your limits, my good sir," as one of her professors at the academy, a polymath, used to say. Nemu praised her silence with a slight nod of her head.
"I made some inquiries at the academy," she said a moment later. "Hence, I know that you do not boost your divination with hallucinogens. I'm pleased about that, for I don't tolerate narcotics."
"I divine without any drugs," confirmed Khonhurimuyo's with some pride. "All I need for an iroscopy is a hook."
"I beg your pardon?"
"You know, a hook."
The novice coughed.
"I mean an object in some way connected to what I'm supposed to dream about. Some kind of thing or picture."
"A picture?"
"Uh-huh. I divine pretty well from a picture."
"Oh," smiled Nemu. "Oh, since a painting will help, there won't be any problem. If you've satisfactorily broken your fast, O first dream reader and 2nd among oniromancers, I ought to explain to you without delay the other reasons why it was you I chose as my assistant."
Cold emanated from the stone walls, alleviated neither by the heavy tapestries nor the darkened wood panelling. The stone floor chilled her feet through the soles of her slippers.
"Beyond that door," she indicated carelessly, "is the laboratory. As has been said before, you may make free use of it. Caution, naturally, is advised. Moderation is particularly recommended during attempts to make brooms carry buckets of water."
Condwiramuirs giggled politely, although the joke was ancient. All the lecturers regaled their charges with jokes referring to the mythical hardships of the mythical sorcerer's apprentice. The stairs wound upwards like a sea serpent, and they were precipitous. Before they arrived at their destination, Condwiramuirs were sweating and panting hard. Nemu showed no signs of effort at all.
"This way, please."
She opened the oak door. "Mind the step." Condwiramuirs entered and gasped. The chamber was a picture gallery. The walls were covered from floor to ceiling with paintings. Hanging there were large old peeling and cracked oils, miniatures, yellowed prints and engravings, faded watercolours and sepias. There were also vividly coloured gouaches and temperas, clean-of-line aquatints and etchings, lithographs and contrasting mezzotints, drawing the gaze with distinctive dots of black. Nemu stopped before the picture hanging nearest the door, portraying a group gathered beneath a great tree. She looked at the canvas, then at Condwiramuirs, and her mute gaze was unusually eloquent.
"Dandelion."
The novice, realizing at once what was expected, didn't make her wait. "Singing a ballad beneath the oak, Bliveris." Nemu smiled and nodded and took a step, stopping before the next painting. A watercolour, symbolism, the silhouettes of two women on a hill. Gulls circling above them, and below a procession of shadows on the hillside.
"Ciri and Trismerigold, the prophetic vision in Caer Morhen."
A smile, a nod, a step, the next painting. A rider at gallop on a horse down an avenue of misshapen alders, extending the arms of their boughs towards him. Condwiramuirs felt a shudder running through her.
"Ciri, it's probably her ride to meet Geralt on the farm of the halfling Hofmeyr."
The next painting, a darkened oil, a battle scene.
"Geralt and Caer defending the bridge on the Yruga."
Then things went more quickly.
"Yennefer and Ciri, their first meeting in the Temple of Melitela. Dandelion and the Dryad Aethne in Brokilon Forest. Geralt's company in a blizzard on the Malheur Pass. Bravo, splendid," interrupted Nemu. "Excellent knowledge of the legend. Now you know the other reason it's you that's here, and not anybody else."
A large canvas portraying the Battle of Brenna overlooked the small ebony table they sat down at. It showed a key moment of the battle, that is, somebody's vulgarly heroic death. The painting was beyond doubt the work of Nikolai Certosa, which could be ascertained by the atmosphere, the perfect attention to detail, and the lighting effects typical for that artist.
"Indeed, I know the legend of the Witcher and the Witcher Girl," replied Condwiramuirs. "I know it, I have no hesitation in saying, thoroughly. I loved that story when I was a young girl. I became engrossed in it. I even dreamed of being Yennefer. I'll be frank, though, even if it was love at first sight, even if it was explosively torrid, my love wasn't everlasting."
Nemu raised her eyebrows.
"I first became acquainted with the story," continued Condwiramuirs, "in popular abridgments and versions for young people, Precy, cut and cleaned up and ad usum Delphini. Later, naturally, I studied the so-called serious and complete versions, extensive to the point of superfluity and at times also beyond. Then passion was replaced by cool reflection and wild desire by something like marital duty, if you know what I mean."
Nemu confirmed she did, with a barely perceptible nod.
"Summing up, I prefer legends that cleave more strongly to legendary convention, do not mix fables with reality, and don't try to integrate the simple, elegant morality of the story with deeply immoral historical truth. I prefer legends to which encyclopedists, archaeologists, and historians don't add epilogues. I prefer it when a prince climbs to the top of the glass mountain, kisses the sleeping princess, she wakes up, and they both live happily ever after. A legend should end like that and no other way." "Who painted that portrait of Ciri, that full-length one?"
"There isn't a single portrait of Ciri."
The voice of the little sorceress was so matter-of-fact it was almost cold.
"Not here, nor anywhere in the world. Not a single portrait has survived. Not a single miniature painted by anybody who could have seen, known, or even remembered Ciri.
That full-length portrait shows Pavetta, Ciri's mother, and it was painted by Rith Dorrit, court artist to the Sintran monarchs. It is known that Dorrit painted Ciri's portrait at the age of 9, also full-length, but the canvas, called Infanta with a Greyhound, was lost, regrettably. Let us, though, return to the legend and your attitude to it, and to how, in your opinion, a legend ought to end. It ought to end happily, said Condwiramures with conviction. Good and righteousness should triumph, evil should be punished exemplarily, and love should unite the lovers until the end of their days, and none of the heroes should bloody die. And the legend of Ciri? How does that end? Precisely. How? Condwiramures was struck dumb for a moment. She hadn't expected a question like that. She sensed a test, an exam, a trap. She said nothing, not wanting to be caught out. How does the legend of Ciri end? But everybody knows that. She looked at a dark-hued watercolour which depicted an amorphous barge gliding over the surface of a mist-shrouded lake, a barge being plied with a long pole by a woman visible only as a black shape. That's exactly how the legend ends, just like that. Nemu read her thoughts. It isn't so certain, Condwiramures. By no means is it certain. I heard the legend, began Nemu, from the lips of a wandering storyteller. I'm a country child, the fourth daughter of the village wheelwright. The times the storyteller Pogfeast, a wandering beggar, dwelled in our village were the most beautiful moments of my childhood. One could take a break from the daily toil, see those fabulous wonders, see that far distant world with the eyes of the soul. A beautiful and marvellous world, more distant and marvellous even than the market in the town 9 miles away from us. I was about 6 or 7 then. My oldest sister was 14 and was already twisted from stooping over her labours, a peasant woman's lot. In our village, girls were prepared for that from childhood. To stoop. Endlessly to stoop. To stoop and bend over our work, over a child, under the weight of a swollen belly forced on you by your man the moment you'd risen from childbed. Those beggar's tales made me begin to wish for something more than a stoop and the daily grind. To dream for something more than the harvest, a husband and children. The first book I bought from the takings of selling brambles gathered in the forest was The Legend of Ciri. The cleaned-up version, as you nicely described it for children, the Preci ad Ursum Delphini. That version was just right for me. I was a poor reader. But already, by then, I knew what I wanted. I wanted to be like Philippa Eilhart, like Sheila de Tankerville, like Azira Var Anahid. They both looked at a gouache depicting a castle chamber, a table and some women sitting around it in subtle chiaroscuro. Legendary women. In the academy where I was admitted, at the second attempt, actually, Nemu continued, I only studied the myth with respect to the Great Lodge during lessons on the history of magic. At first, I simply didn't have time to read for pleasure. I had to focus in order to keep up with the darling daughters of counts and bankers to whom everything came easily, who laughed at lasses from the country. She fell silent and cracked her knuckles. I finally found time for reading, she continued, but then I realized that the vicissitudes of Geralt and Ciri entertained me much less than they had during my childhood. A similar syndrome to yours occurred. What did you call it? Marital duties? It was like that until... She fell silent and rubbed her face. Condwiramures noticed in amazement that the hand of the Lady of the Lake was trembling. I suppose I was 18 when... When something happened. Something that made the legend of Ciri live in me again. That made me begin to involve myself with it seriously as a scholar. Made me begin to devote my life to it. The novice remained silent, although curiosity was raging inside her.
Don't pretend you don't know,
Nemo said tartly.
Everyone knows that the Lady of the Lake is possessed by a literally pathological obsession about the legend of Ciri. Everybody gossips about how an initially harmless fad transformed into something like an addiction to narcotics, or simply a mania.
There is a good deal of truth to those rumours, my dear Condwillamures. A good deal.
And you, since I chose you as my assistant, will also descend into mania and dependency, for I shall demand it. At least for the time of your apprenticeship. Do you understand?
The novice nodded.
You think you understand.
Nemo regained control of herself and calmed down.
But I shall explain it to you, gradually. And when the time comes, I shall explain everything to you. For the time being.
She broke off and looked through the window at the lake, at the black line of the Fisher King's boat clearly standing out from the shimmering golden surface of the water.
For the time being, rest. Look at the gallery. You will find in the cupboards and display cases albums and boxes of engravings, all thematically linked to the tale. In the library are all the legends, versions, and adaptations, and also most of the scholarly treatises. Devote some time to them. Have a good look. Read and concentrate. I want you to have some material for your dreams. A hook, as you called it. I will. Madame Nemo?
Yes.
Those two portraits, hanging beside each other, aren't they of Ciri either?
Not a single portrait of Ciri exists, Nemo repeated patiently. Later artists only painted her in scenes, each according to their own imagination. As far as those portraits are concerned, the one on the left is more likely a free variation on the subject, since it depicts the she-elf, Lara Dorin Epshaedal, a person the artist couldn't have known. For the artist is Lydia van Brandevoort, who's certainly familiar to you from the legend. One of her surviving oils still hangs in the academy.
I know. And the other portrait?
Nemo looked long at the picture, at the image of a slender girl with fair hair and a sad expression, wearing a white dress with green sleeves.
It was painted by Robin Anderida, she said, turning around and looking Condwillamures straight in the eyes.
And who it portrays?
You tell me, dream reader and nyromancer. Explain it. And tell me about your dream.
Master Robin Anderida was the first to see the Emperor approaching and bowed. Stella Congreve, Countess of Lidertal, stood up and curtsied, gesturing to the girl seated on a carved armchair to do the same.
Greetings, ladies.
Emir Va Emris inclined his head.
Greetings to you too, Master Robin. How goes the work?
Master Robin coughed in embarrassment and bowed again, nervously wiping his fingers on his smock. Emir knew that the artist suffered from acute agoraphobia and was pathologically shy. But whose concern was that? What mattered was how well he painted. The Emperor, as was customary when he was travelling, was wearing an officer's uniform of the Imperial Guards Brigade, black armour and a cloak with an embroidered silver salamander. He walked over and looked at the portrait. First at the portrait, and only afterwards at the model. A slender girl with fair hair and a wistful gaze. She was wearing a white dress with green sleeves, with a slight décolletage decorated with a peridot necklace.
Excellent,
he said intentionally into space, so they wouldn't know who he was praising.
Excellent, Master. Please continue without paying attention to me.
A word, if you would, Countess. He walked away towards the window, making her follow him.
I ride, he said quietly. State affairs. Thank you for your hospitality. And for her. For the princess. Good work indeed, Stella. Truly deserving of praise, both for you and her.
Stella Congreve curtsied low and gracefully.
Your Imperial Majesty is too good to us.
Don't speak too soon.
Oh. She pursed her lips slightly. Has it come to that?
It has.
What will become of her, Emir?
I don't know, he replied. In 10 days I renew the offensive in the north, and it promises to be an exacting, a very exacting war. Vatier de Rido is monitoring plots and conspiracies aimed at me. Reasons of state may force on me very extreme acts.
That child is not to blame for anything.
I said reasons of state. Reasons of state have nothing in common with justice. In any case,
he waved a hand. I want to talk to her, alone.
Come closer, princess. Closer? Closer, look lively. Your emperor commands.
The girl curtsied low. Emir looked her up and down, returning in his memory to that momentous audience in Loch Grimm. He was full of appreciation, nay, admiration for Stella Congreve, who in the course of the 6 months that had passed since that moment had managed to transform the ugly duckling into a little noblewoman.
Leave us, he commanded. Take a break, Master Robin, to clean your brushes, let's say, while I would ask you, Countess, to wait in the antechamber. And you, Princess, follow me onto the terrace.
The wet snow which had fallen in the night was melting in the first rays of the morning sun, and the roofs of the towers and pinnacles of Don Rowan Castle were still wet and glistened as though on fire. Emir went over to the balcony's balustrade. The girl, in keeping with protocol, hung back 3 paces. He gestured impatiently for her to come closer. The Emperor said nothing for a long time, resting both hands on the balustrade, staring at the hills and the evergreen yews covering them, clearly distinct from the white limestone of the rocky vaults. The river glinted, a ribbon of molten silver winding through the valley. Spring was in the air.
I reside here too seldom, said Emir.
The girl said nothing.
I come here too seldom, he repeated, turning around. And it's a beautiful place, exuding calm, a beautiful region. Do you agree with me?
Yes, Your Imperial Majesty.
Spring is in the air. Am I right?
Yes, Your Imperial Majesty.
From below in the courtyard came the sound of singing, disturbed by clanking, rattling, and the clattering of horseshoes. The escort, informed that the Emperor had ordered his departure, was hurriedly making ready for the road. Emir remembered that among the guardsmen was one who sang, often, and regardless of circumstances.
Look on me graciously, with eyes of cornflower blue, grant me mercifully your fondness so true. Think on me mercifully, and at this night hour, decline me not graciously, but receive me to your bower. A pretty ballad, he said ponderously, touching his heavy gold imperial necklace with his fingers.
It is, Your Imperial Majesty.
Vatier assures me he is on Vilgefort's trail, that finding him is a question of days, at most, weeks. The traitors' heads will fall, and the real Cyrilla, Queen of Sintra, will be brought to Nilfgaard. And before the authentic Cyrilla, Queen of Sintra, comes to Nilfgaard, something will have to be done with her lookalike. Raise your head.
She obeyed.
Do you have any wishes? He asked suddenly and harshly. Any complaints? Requests?
No, Your Imperial Highness, I do not.
Indeed. Interesting. Ah, well, but I can't exactly order you to have any. Raise your head as befits a princess. Stella has taught you manners, I trust.
Yes, Your Imperial Majesty.
Indeed. They have taught her well, he thought. First Rayons, and then Stella. They've taught her the roles and lines well, no doubt threatening her with torture and death for a slip or mistake. They warned her she would have to perform before a cruel audience, unforgiving of errors, before the awe-inspiring Emir Var Emrys, Emperor of Nilfgaard.
"What's your name?"
he asked abruptly.
"Cyrilla Fiona Ellen Rhiannon."
"Your real name?"
"Cyrilla Fiona, do not try my patience. Your name?"
"Cyrilla..." The girl's voice broke like a twig.
"Fiona..."
"That will do by the great sun," he said between clenched teeth. "That will do." She sniffed loudly, contrary to protocol. Her mouth trembled, but protocol did not forbid that.
"Calm yourself," he commanded, but in a soft and almost gentle voice. "What do you fear? Are you ashamed of your own name? Are you afraid to disclose it? If I ask, it is only because I'd like to address you by your rightful name. But I have to know what it sounds like."
"It sounds dull," she answered, and her huge eyes suddenly gleamed like emeralds lit by a flame.
"For it is a dull name, Your Imperial Majesty. A name just right for somebody who's a nobody. As long as I am Cyrilla Fiona, I mean something. As long as..."
Her voice stuck in her throat so abruptly that she involuntarily brought her hands up to her neck, as though what was around it was not a necklace, but a garrote. Emir continued to measure her with his gaze, still full of appreciation for Stella Congreve. At the same time, he felt anger. Unjustified anger. Unjustified and therefore very infuriating.
"What do I want from this child?" he thought, feeling the anger rising in him, seething in him, frothing up like soup in a pot. "What do I want from this child, whom..."
"Know that I had nothing to do with your abduction, girl," he said sharply. "I didn't have anything to do with your kidnapping. I didn't issue any such orders. I was deceived."
He was furious with himself, aware he was making a mistake. He ought to have ended the conversation much earlier, ended it haughtily, arrogantly, menacingly, as befitted an emperor. He ought to have forgotten about this girl with the green eyes, this girl that did not exist. She was a double, an imitation. She didn't even have a name. She was nobody.
The emperor does not ask for forgiveness, does not demean himself before someone who...
"Forgive me," he said.
And the words were unfamiliar, clung unpleasantly to his lips.
"I committed an error. Yes, it's true, I'm guilty of what happened to you. I was at fault. But I give you my word that you are in no danger. Nothing ill will befall you. No harm, no discredit, no woe. You needn't be afraid."
"I'm not."
She raised her head and looked him straight in the eyes, contrary to protocol. Emir shuddered, moved by the honesty and trust of her gaze. He immediately stood erect, imperious and repellently supercilious.
"Ask me for whatever you wish."
She looked at him again, and he involuntarily recalled the innumerable occasions when he had so easily bought himself ease of conscience for the harm or pain he'd caused somebody, secretly and reprehensibly pleased that he was paying so little.
"Ask me for whatever you wish," he repeated.
And because he was already weary, his voice suddenly gained in humanity.
"I'll make your every wish come true." "If only she wouldn't look at me," he thought. "I can't bear her gaze." "Apparently people are afraid to look at me," he thought. "So what, them, am I afraid of? Vatier de Rido can shove his reasons of state. If she asks, I'll have her taken home, where she was snatched from. I'll order her taken there in a golden carriage and six. All she need do is ask."
"Ask me for whatever you wish," he repeated.
Thank you, Your Imperial Majesty, said the girl, lowering her eyes.